Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And today it is the rock and roll as Sebastian Bach returns to TIJ. It's just as crazy and as chaotic as you think it's going to be. Dude, I went to Sebastian's house in LA and sat in his living room with him and his three-year-old stepson Trace and his turntable and album collection. Sebastian's a vinyl collector and he's going to walk us through some of his more recent album finds and play some of them for us, which he insisted. But the real reason why I was at Baz's house was to talk about his tremendous new book, 18 in Life on Skid Row. It's out now and it's a great read. Sebastian wrote it himself. He was actually influenced by my four books. It really is the epitome of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's everything the metal scene was in the late 80s and early 90s. And you're going to hear a couple of the stories that Sebastian wrote about in the book right here on this show, including stuff from Skid Row's tour with Guns N' Roses in the early days, stories with their tour with Pantera, a great prank that Pantera pulled on Sebastian when they opened for Skid Row. Sebastian's run-in with Tommy Lee of Motley Crue backstage in Moscow and the entire Bon Jovi family, father included. Of course, the infamous San Francisco night he and Lars Ulrich, Talk is Jericho alumni, when they stayed up partying all night, and what happened with Sebastian's grandmother came knocking on the door the next morning. It's another wild ride with one of my favorite characters in rock and roll, Sebastian Bach. It's coming up.
Talk is Jericho.
We're at Sebastian Bach's house in the Hollywood Hills.
And we're rolling, right?
We're rolling, dude.
That's
yeah.
Great.
We're listening. We put on some April Wine.
Yes.
Which is perfect. Two Canadians.
I like Sebastian Bach.
I like the Bach.
That's right.
I like to rock.
Some like the Bach, baby. Woo!
Dude, did you ever used to sing these songs? Did
oh,
you ever
all
do
the
a lot
time.
Of, yeah, because like there was in the early 80s this amazing time of all these great Canadian bands that came out about the same time frame.
Well, let's paint the picture for our listeners here. We are in my living room. I have four record players in this house. There's an insane system in the dining room. This is the best one here. I got another one downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're
I collect
vinyl
it.
File,
yeah, man. It sounds great to me. Mm-hmm. It just sounds... See, what vinyl does is it captures the year that it was made. This sounds like 78 to me, or 81. Or
as
whenever
far as
it came
the
out.
Sound, the,
yeah,
the vibe
because
of it.
Think of the variables involved in putting out an album. You're talking about the equipment that it's... Everything that touches it from recording to mastering to where it's mastered to what it's mastered on to... What the technology was at that time, you know what I'm
right,
saying?
Right.
So when you buy an old record that was made then, that's what it sounded like then.
Yeah.
That's what I'm interested in.
That's interesting, yeah.
And, you know, I read an article online, like, of the bands in the mid-90s, like Smash Mouth. Okay, their big hit, Mr. Rockstar, whatever.
Walking
hey now,
sun.
You're a rock star.
Oh, yeah.
They tried to remix that, okay, for a new release recently, okay? But what happened was, you know when you buy your computer, all the plugins, like Netscape Communicator, stuff that was out in 96, okay?
Right?
They recorded that song with these outdated plugins that don't exist anymore. So when they called it back up on the board without all these computer plugins, it's unmixable.
It's like obsolete. Oh, wow.
So it's like some songs, if you don't have your Netscape Communicator version 2, you know what I mean?
It can never be changed.
That's right.
Stuck
so
forever.
That's why when people get in this argument about analog versus digital, I'm a member of this Facebook group called Kiss My Wax, which is fanatical about collecting records. And there's an argument on there that has to do with the reissues that came out versus the original copies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the reissues are awesome, but they sound like 2014 when
right,
you put
right.
them on.
Yeah,
when
yeah,
you
yeah.
get a clean original copy of a record, it sounds like the year it was made.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's such a collector's premium now.
For that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, though. Like, you forget, too, when you listen to a record sonically.
Yeah.
how much better it is, how much more detail, how intricate it is, the tambourine. Like right now, actually, the tambourine is going to come in, and you can hear it. Whereas if you're listening through your iPhone, just by, I mean, it's impossible because it's a small little speaker.
That's right.
But that's what most music is listened to now.
I know. Well,
you know,
I don't listen to that like that. I do when I'm on the go, okay? On the airplane, I can't bring my record player.
Yeah. Right.
So there's definitely something to be said for that. And you
know, those guys that tour, like we did a tour with Theory of a Dead Man, and they bring their record player on the road with them in a road case and set it up.
Do they have one on the bus?
I don't think they have one on the bus.
I want to put one on the bus.
But you'd have to get some kind of a moving like base for it.
But it would be so killer to play records on the bus.
Yeah. Oh. So do you collect vinyl?
Yes.
Like intensely to where you buy rare stuff as well?
Yeah. I just went to the Pasadena record swap yesterday and I picked up Queen Sheer Heart Attack Japanese pressing.
Wow, okay.
From 72. It's right over there. $30. That was the most I paid. Steely Dan Pretzel Logic Quadraphonic Mix. Okay? Like, you never see that.
Yeah, right.
It sounds crazy.
Do you?
I like the special versions of records that were put out then, but like mobile fidelity sound versions or the audiophile versions of old records are crazy.
So it's real technical stuff that you're talking about here.
Well, they would print special versions, like half speed mastered version of like Doobie Brothers Minute by Minute.
It
makes you cry, or like white label promos.
Now what is that?
That's like a first ever printing of a record. So I got all of these yesterday.
At Amoeba, or where'd you get them from?
Pasadena.
Oh, so the Pasadena.
It's a first
like a flea market.
Yeah. This is an Aerosmith white label promo. Hold this, dude. Like that's like a test press.
Right.
So you can't get much more close to the sound that Aerosmith
Night in
was
the
going for.
And it says demonstration not for sale. Right?
This is what I bought yesterday. I love that's like a treasure to me.
And just finding this in a flea market.
Yeah, I know, right? What I pay? $19
for the white label.
Here's
promo.
Your $19.
Yeah, dude. Space 1999. The exciting new
on
hit
vinyl.
Series on vinyl.
I've never seen that.
Do they tell
never
stories on here or something?
I haven't
music
even put
on
it on. I haven't, but I bought it just for fun.
And that's what they used to do. They would.
I got this with like the order form. We're looking at draw the line T-shirt special offer order form.
Yeah, you can.
I paid a whopping $6
for that.
Super disc. Listen to the difference, Doobie Brothers.
This
Donald's.
Is more the sonically.
Yeah, an audiophile
higher.
Version of like What a Fool Believes.
Wow, the great album cover of the Doobie Brothers. Jeff Skunk Baxter just killing it.
Aerosmith Rocks, which I already have, but I bought this only because it's a first pressing for $3.
$3.
I'll take it. Here's the quadraphonic Steely Dan.
Steely Dan Pretzel Logic.
ABC Records.
And it actually says quadraphonic on it. Command quadraphonic. Wow.
Queen.
And then the Japanese sheer heart attack.
72.
With the Japanese vinyl. This one was a little more expensive. $30.
Yeah, which is well worth it. The Japanese vinyl is much thicker.
Yeah, gives you quality, better sound.
In one day, that makes me happy, man. Yeah. Those are like treasures to me.
And this is one thing I always love talking, because you are still a huge music fan. Like, you love, even though you're a huge rock star in your own right, you still, in a second, would be asking Brian May, you know, to tell you stories about Sheer Heart Attack, you know?
Yeah. But I'm also like a collector. I love collecting things and comics. And this vinyl thing is like so fun, because for years, like everybody else, I've just been downloading files onto my phone.
Yeah.
And it's so different. Like, that's such a different scene.
Right.
You can't stumble across a Japanese first pressing MP3 on the internet. Like,
I used to love.
I found.
I used to love the experience of buying an album where you had the plastic and you would run your thumb down the side of
and
it.
And it smelled, too.
Yeah, you would smell the vinyl smell.
I love that.
And then pull it out and be excited if there was liner notes.
Right.
Some bands didn't have them.
That's
AC/DC never had them.
True.
But then, you know, you're talking about like Kiss or Iron Maiden. They would take advantage of this.
Yeah.
And always give you something cool.
Like a Cracker Jack box.
Yeah.
You know, it was like,
AC/DC is Skid Row. I don't want to touch them.
Who do you like? I love this.
Skid Row, Trey. Skid Row.
We could be coming to Sebastian's house. We got music playing. We're looking at records. Trace is hanging great. Out. He's 3 years old.
There's my dog,
Your
Oliver.
Dog is around. Everybody's around.
We got coffee going.
Coffee's coming over. Your lovely Woo! Wife bringing the coffee over.
Hey, baby.
It's a classic right. Sebastian. Oh, and I got the. Oh, he gets the.
Perfect. Oh, kiss her. Oh. We'll get away from the Japanese first person.
don't spill the coffee. I got an incredible
can you do me
Hulk
a favor?
Mug.
Put these albums over there. Thank you.
You got the Kiss mug.
You can't have those anywhere near.
Okay. So we're here. We want to talk about your great new book.
Thank you.
It's really well done. Yeah, 18 in Life with on Skid Row.
That's right.
With Skid Row or on Skid
on
Row?
On
Skid Row.
Think life on Skid Row.
got it.
Do you understand?
With an 18
like, it doesn't matter.
In front of it.
Well, that's when it started.
Yeah.
But it's a life sentence.
you never escape.
What do you get when it's 18 and life? On Skid Row. what do you get?
But, dude, we talk-
What that reference is that it doesn't matter whether they kick me out of the band or whether I'm in the band or whether I'm not in the band. Just like Vince Neil or countless other frontmen that label's put on me for the rest of my life. That's just the way it is.
You're always going to be the voice.
When I walk out this door, that's what I hear, along with the Gilmore Girls, Trailer Park Boys. But, you know, that's just... public. That's the public.
But you see, we have a lot in common, though. You're very good at building the Sebastian Bach brand. You've done a lot of stuff. You just mentioned very briefly things you've done outside of rock and roll. Gilmore Girls, the whole Broadway experience, the Trailer Park Boys. I mean, you've done a good job at kind of doing a lot of different things.
Thank you for saying that. And one of my favorite reviews of the book, like the LA Weekly, they were doing an interview with me, and the guy came out and said, he goes, okay, you haven't been in Skid Row for a long time, but do you think that because you haven't been in that band, that your career has been more interesting? And I didn't, it was like, if you're looking as far as content versus form, I would say my career has been more interesting.
Because you were not
because
in Skid Row.
I'm just saying I have been allowed to do different things that possibly I would not have been able to do if I was just in that band and I was not allowed to do anything else.
It almost forced you to have to.
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah. I had to just concentrate on what's in the album or what's in the show as to what the name of it.
It's interesting because you're talking about, you know, leaving Skid Row, being out of Skid Row, getting kicked out, whatever it may be. A lot of guys would instantly go and start doing their own record, or you actually go the other way around and go to Broadway. I know it wasn't right after, but it was fairly quickly.
It was
after.
Right after, pretty much. No, well,
three,
yeah.
4 years, maybe.
4 years, that's right.
Right.
I just love singing, and I liked singing before I liked rock and roll. If anybody that's read the book knows that I was in the church choir, and rock and roll definitely came to me the same way Broadway came to me. I didn't ever go try to be on Broadway. They were told by Jason Flom, because they came to him, they go, we want a rock star. He was the one that told them, it's Sebastian. That's the guy that will do this. And he had to convince me that I could do it. I didn't think I could do it.
As far as the acting side of it?
I didn't think I was a good enough actor because I had never done it. I had only done acting in high school. Mm-hmm. I actually did do one major play in high school, but
obviously not the same. But
it was after Magritte, Tom Stoppard. I played the inspector. but anyways, when I went to see the play Jekyll and Hyde, it immediately reminded me of Lakefield College School where I went. Because like there were songs in there that I sang in my choir. Like Land of Hope and Glory. There's a scene at the end of the play where Dr. Jekyll gets married. And the choir's singing an old hymn that I used to sing in my choir.
Right.
And I'm watching this and going, this is crazy.
Yeah,
I have to do this. Uh-huh. So I love doing it. I just love singing. I don't have rules, even in heavy metal. Like my goal right now, I'm about to start on a new record. And my goal is to totally make a vinyl album as far as the sound and everything. Okay? Like I'm going to concentrate on that. Mm-hmm. Whatever process that entails, I'm going to make a record like this April Wine record that I can drop the needle. It'll have these kind of sound qualities
vinyl first.
Yes.
Download
then the
after.
CD. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
That's
right.
What I want to do. I can do whatever I want to do. That's what I want to do. So that's what I'm going to try as hard as I can to do. What were we talking about before?
Well, you mentioned I'll take it over. You're talking about we're talking about the play and all these different things that you do, and one of them now is being an author and writing a book,
right?
Because you can do anything you want. Now, one thing I found interesting is that you wrote this book yourself,
100%,
which is what I've done the same thing.
Yeah, that's the
it comes
way to
through.
Go. Right on.
It sounds like talking to Sebastian Bach.
Well, when the lawyer, you know how you have to go through this process of the lawyer,
the legal draft. Yeah,
yeah. I hated that. That made me not want to put the book out because he told me all the ways.
And get sued.
Was there a lot of things
you had to change because of that?
Well, they told me to change the names of my childhood friends who, like, I did acid with. I go, those guys will be stoked.
Yeah. They made the book.
They go, there's no way I've changed it. But
the record is ended. Yeah. We just need a robot arm to change it over.
Well, you remember those old...
They did have those, didn't they?
No, you remember you could get record players that would change it for you?
Yeah. They would pick it up and turn it over and drop
okay,
it down.
Let's go for this record.
All right, we went from... Oh, you're actually opening it?
I've never even listened.
See, look at that. You actually are sticking your thumb in there and opening the album. I can't see the cover of it, though. What is it? Oh, so it's a Sebastian Bach.
Yes.
Kicking and screaming.
Screaming on vinyl. I don't have Give 'Em Hell on vinyl. Pretty clean.
That was one of the things that like made me feel like a rock star when my record came out on vinyl.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean? Yeah, because
yeah.
You know
you did send me one.
Yeah, of the vinyl, absolutely. Because like you said, you can actually hold it. You're looking at it. You see the actual dudes in the band.
The sound.
We're talking about writing the book. Oh, you look at this. Trace just drew me a picture. Thank you, buddy.
So nice.
Well, I drew one for Sebastian as well.
What is that, Trace?
It's a tiger, I think.
Is that a tiger?
No.
Oh, is...
What is this? This is Dasha. Okay, let's do our interview here, buddy.
Okay.
Thank you. Writing the book...
The chaos of Sebastian.
Imagine like driving around like in your truck, listening to this.
You're like, what the hell is going on?
They really are in his living room.
Yeah, we really are. This is the real Sebastian. I always love talking to you because it always goes off into chaotic
That's
direction.
That's funny.
Which is half the love of it, though. But so, we're talking about writing a book and writing yourself
okay,
in your voice.
The lawyer. The lawyer. So he reads me back the part. He goes,
let me read this back to you. And I go, I was in the air going to Moscow. Tommy Lee came up. I had a bottle of Jack. We started drinking Jack. Okay, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
And then Tommy wanted to beat my ass. He goes, did you... He pulled me across... Like, he was walking towards me backstage in Moscow.
And I was like, hey! He was with all the Motley. Nikki, Vince, Mick. They were coming this way, and I was coming this way. And I go, hey, man. Hey, guys. Tommy fucking grabs me. Pulls me aside into a fence. He goes, did you f-ing tell somebody that I f-ing drank Jack in the plane? The lawyer's reading this to me, and he's going, no, I didn't. Well, yes, I did. No, I didn't. Well, yes, I did. No, I didn't. Yes, I did. Of course I f-ing did. And the lawyer's reading, he goes, that was as cool as getting a platinum record in 89, doing a shot with Tommy Lee of Motley Crue in a fucking plane going to Russia. Of course I told everybody. And the lawyer's reading it back to me. He goes, you really did write this yourself, didn't you? And I go, yeah. He goes, because it's stuff like this that you never would have got in your book if somebody else wrote it.
Yes, exactly.
Like the way you're describing it and shit.
Sure.
No, I didn't. Yes, I did. No, I did. Of course I did. He goes, the only one I could write that
so did,
what is
did
you.
Sandy after that? Was he...
I haven't, you know, funnily enough, Tommy Lee's sister said she's coming over here right now.
Okay.
I haven't talked to Tommy in a while. You know what the funny thing is about the book? People were worried if people were going to get mad, you know, about shit I'm writing about. I haven't heard one thing from anybody except for Eddie Trunk. He's the only guy that I heard anything about.
What did he say?
That's a whole other story. But Eric Luffglass too is another. Those are the only guys that go, hey, what's up? And like, no, and nobody cares about like what happened on the last show of the Bon Jovi tour.
Right,
like,
right. Yeah.
Because there was a crazy headline in the New York Post the day the book came out. It goes, John Bon Jovi's father, quote unquote, threatened to kill Sebastian Bach. That was the headline in the Post. And I'm like, that's a crazy headline.
What a great
clickbait. But who cares, though? This was a long time
ago. Tell that story briefly.
That was just that was an instance where I learned if you insult one Italian, the whole family is coming at you.
Right. But plus two
words. In Canada, like, it's not really like you saw the Canadian, the grandpa really doesn't come down and kick your... But I guess in Italy, that's the way they do it.
Did you insult them from stage when you were opening for them? Is that
well, as you remember, back in those days, there was this whole custom of end-of-tour hijinks, which was where bands would play pranks on each other. I hated that shit.
Throwing eggs on you or silly string or...
It's fucking hard enough trying to sing that shit.
Yeah.
I don't need to be being pelted with fart bombs or whatever. And so, you know, so I never liked that.
Right.
But that was... You got to read the book for the end of that. But that was when Bon Jovi was pranking Skid Row and...
Dumped a bunch of cold milk on
you. Yeah, they took
my...
Yeah. It's better in the book.
But it's just the basic story. Like,
well,
you
okay.
You can't just dump that,
I was
that
walking,
headline.
Okay, I was walking to the stage. The lights went black for the opening of the show. The arena's pitch black. Three or four roadies, I couldn't see because I'm going like this, grab me by my back, pull me under the stage and by the back of the hair and shove my head into a vat of ice milk. Milk. Not even water.
Yeah, milk.
Milk! I go, what the f***? And I came up, and you know when you go swimming and it's too cold and your bones go, wah, vertigo?
Yeah.
I f***ing had vertigo. And the song's going.
Like the opening track.
Yes! My song! And I run up there. And I'm dripping in milk, and Rachel is saying, what the f***? Like I missed the whole first verse. So, but bands used to do that.
Right,
we
right.
all used to do that. I think one of the stupider times was when I was on the road in '97 with Pantera, my solo band. Out of the goodness of their heart, nobody knew why, but they brought me on tour for 2 weeks. Pantera and Anthrax and my solo band. And one time I go on stage and my lips start fucking burning. I go, what the fuck? And I started wiping. Then I wiped it in my eyes, and my eyes are burning on stage, like really bad. I go, what the? And I turn and I look, and Dimebag is over there with a bottle of Tabasco, and they had doused my mic in f***ing Tabasco like this, and it sucked. It really sucked. But they were laughing their heads off.
But they took you out because you took Skid Row took Pantera out when they were just a young band.
We took them on the Vulgar Display of Power tour, and that was how they broke. I'm not saying that's why they broke, but making it big in rock and roll is a combination of timing and opportunity. And that is when Pantera broke, was on the road with Skid Row.
Sure.
I mean, Guy Sykes and Rex Brown can try to rewrite history in their book, but that's the fact. They didn't make it opening up for Sacred Reich, okay? Like, give me a f***ing break.
But that must have been a good kick in the ass for you guys, because Skid Row is a deceptively heavy band. Like, you think of Skid Row, a lot of people think 18 in Life, which is a great side of Skid Row, but... Heavy, heavy, heavy stuff, especially on Slave to the Grind and Forward.
Monkey Business is ridiculous.
Very heavy. Slave
Threat.
Is heavy.
Threat,
the threat
is ridiculous.
Heavy. You know, Riot Act. There's a lot of great stuff on there.
You know what's really Frozen off of great the beginning of that is
great.
Really crazy. I'm thinking of adding that back to the start.
So when you go on tour with Pantera at this time frame and seeing how heavy and how intense they were, did that influence you?
Well, some certain gigs. I mean, when you go and you do a tour, it's 100 gigs, you know. So some nights are different than others, but I will tell you that a couple nights was no fun following those motherfuckers because they were on fire.
Yeah.
This is when Phil Anselmo performed shirtless every night. That's how long ago that shit was. I mean, he was ripped. He was like a god. He looked like Rollins.
Right.
All working out and
And a different style of look at the time, like kind of a shave.
Yeah, but meme. Yeah, meme.
You know, rock bands are supposed to have long hair, but
cool.
Not him.
Right, but he cared about his appearance then. I'm not saying he doesn't now, but he doesn't now. He did then. He did. He was a front man who looked amazing on stage and intimidating and what with them amazing songs.
Sure.
And their live power, they were deadly.
And almost changing the style of what was happening.
Yeah, there was no band that sounded, they sounded like Slayer meets ZZ Top.
Right.
That's what they sound like. With a Van Halen vibe of fun.
They had groove.
Yes,
which
that's right.
A lot of people don't associate with Pantera, but that was their secret.
Their
pocket. Yeah. You know, it was a perfect band for that.
They had very intelligent lyrics, I thought, at the time. Mm. Now that there's that controversy that happened. I don't know if those lyrics were saying something that I didn't even know.
Didn't think about, yeah.
Which freaks me out, and I hate thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really none of my business.
Right, sure.
Talk is Jericho.
So when we were talking about writing a book, and obviously, like you said, it takes so much time, and your book is long.
Yeah.
The 400 plus pages.
I wanted it to be content because you only get one chance to make a first impression, and my whole vibe, just the way, same as Broadway, I want to write many, many books. I don't want, like, you've written three books.
Yeah.
That's incredible to me. I enjoy writing. That's why, like, I like it.
Yeah.
You know, I like it.
It's like making a record. You start with nothing, and you create this thing, and you're constantly revising it.
It's like making a very long record.
Yeah. Right. I equaled it out. Like, if you're talking about how much money you make per hour writing a book, it's about 7 cents.
That's right.
You know, because you're putting hundreds of hours into this
thing. It took me four years
to do it.
You know, I got to say, writing about your childhood is more fun writing about your adulthood.
Yeah. Well, because you have to really think back.
But also, when you're a kid, you're so innocent and wide-eyed. And if you really describe what that's like, it's like a joy to write about when you're a little boy, you know. And then you become an adult, and you're like, then this happened. And they're like, life is heavy.
But I loved reading about your dad, because obviously your dad's always kind of been a part of your legacy. Painted the Slave to the Grind cover.
Yes, he did.
You know, reading about him as a dude.
He was wild.
And, you know, it must have been kind of interesting for you to go back.
You know, I judge things on whether this is going to sound really, I don't know. Okay. You know, on Netflix, you're allowed to rate every movie. And I love doing that because everybody rates my shit. So I can't, every time I watch, I'm going, what am I going to give this? Is this 3 stars, 4 stars, five stars? Only time I will give a 5-star is when tears come to my eyes. That sounds really.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the word.
Flaky.
Yeah. We used to use a different word.
Yeah, no, we know what we're talking
about. We can't use that anymore. But anyways, but if that happens, and it does a lot, then I give the movie 5 stars. Because what am I watching it for? I want to feel something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, we're talking about dads and stuff. I remember watching the movie Thor, the first Marvel Thor. And I was watching, I was enjoying it. I was formulating my review, though. And I was going, this is like a 4-star. Not quite a 5, but not a 3. Like, I really dug it. Then the scene happened where that giant robot was in the town. And Thor didn't have his hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And that fucking huge thing's coming at him. And then his dad in heaven says, give him the fucking hammer. And it comes through space. Like, that killed me.
Wow.
That destroyed me. That made me cry, and that made Thor a 5-star movie.
Okay, right.
Because that's a dad thing, mm-hmm. you know, and a son.
Protecting the son.
I think, you know, as much as I can't even fathom the new politic scene that we live in, I can't even deal with it. I don't have anything to say because it doesn't matter now. Mm-hmm. But, like, Tom Brady catches shit for being Donald Trump's friend, right? But then he's like crying on TV about his dad.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't care if he likes Donald Trump. Yeah. Like, I'm relating to him.
Because
I think everybody feels like that. Even if, either if they love them or they hate them. Because it's a thin line, you know?
Yeah.
People that were abused by their parents hate them more than anything.
Right.
But my dad turned me on to rock and roll and comic books.
It's a great story of when he took you to see Kiss.
It changed my whole personality.
It's one of the best stories in the book. Yeah.
Well, that made me cry.
Uh-huh.
Because it's all about family and rock and roll together. And that's when I knew my book was very close to being done. Okay. Because if I'm reading it and I'm getting that reaction, I go, okay, you're pretty much done. Like, because if you can't even read it, like, what? How else? How much more do you want to do?
All right. You also had a great kind of a mindset where you weren't not protecting anything, but you let it all hang out.
Well,
all
you know,
the stuff.
Some no, I didn't really. There was okay. Lots more. All right. I
there's plenty of stories in there though where you did let it hang out.
Yeah, but going into writing a book, I was like, oh, I'm going to tell this sex story. I was thinking a lot about sex, like guys think about sex, right? And I have a lot of shit that I can tell, and I wrote a lot of it down, planning to have it in the book. Then I would read it back. Go.
Then she unzipped my fly and reached for my manhood.
And I go, dude, you're like Billy Bush on a fucking train with Donald Trump grabbing pussy. Like, what are you doing? Like, I just felt like a creep reading it back. Like, it didn't feel right. Like, what are you, are you a musician? Are you John Holmes? Like, what?
You're kind of bragging about it.
I didn't. Because a book's forever.
And the thing is, it's obvious. I mean, dude, 1989, you're like the epitome of a rock star. Good-looking guy, great hair, great singer. It's pretty much common knowledge that you're probably having a lot of female...
Before I got married, yeah.
Yeah, of course. But so you don't have to hammer that home. We get it.
And I don't like
when... We know it. It's
thank
obvious.
God. Good. Yeah. I don't like to read.
Right.
I mean, to
right.
me, that's kind of gross.
I read Paul Di'Anno's book.
Oh, I didn't
and
read
he's
that.
Talking about, like, every chapter. I shagged this book.
No,
I shagged
I'm
that
not book. Into
it's like, dude.
It's like...
You're like, enough. We get it, Paul. Okay, great.
See, I read Joe Perry's... I've read all the books. I'm sure you have, too. Yeah. Joe Perry's blew me away. I loved it. It was just about music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I'm like, this is what I'm into.
Yeah.
I'm into
that's
music.
The story
I'm into
I
it.
Tell.
That's what I'm into.
Yeah.
I don't care how many chicks he f***ed. Like, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean
the rock and roll
a little
story.
Of that goes a long way. And there is some in there, but not nothing.
What I did like was, it's a great quote, and I've heard it before, but it's like, you know, I didn't like cocaine. I liked the way it smelled.
I think I stole that from someone.
It's got to be from like Lemmy or something. It's a great rock and roll quote. You know what I mean?
They wanted to put that in the. They put that in the back of. I go. I don't want that in the back of the book. They go. No, we love that. We love that. I go. Okay.
There's so many great stories, and trust me, it's a great book. But there's one story I want you to tell the story about you and Lars and your grandmother.
Oh, it's a long. I don't, you know, I don't want to just give it away, but. You know, back in those days, we did a lot of coke. This is a long time ago. That's why, you know, everything is dated in the book. I put where it happened,
when the year
was, you know, because I don't want anybody thinking that he's doing this shit now on his new tour, you know, because it's just, this is about a long time ago. But the fact of the matter is, in the 80s and early 90s, rock and roll bands did cocaine. We liked it. We thought it was killer.
That's just the way it was.
We didn't know any different. That's the way it was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we went to Lars, like, hey, Sebastian, let's go score some blow. And I'm like, all right. So, this was after me and Lars and Steven Tyler went to the Farrell Brothers strip club, that iconic, I can't remember the name of it. They made a movie about it.
In Hollywood?
No, a big movie about this strip club that's in San Francisco. The O'Farrell Brothers.
The Farrelly Brothers?
Something
okay,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So Steven Tyler and me and Lars went there. And they hand out laser pointers to people so you can like point at their pussies and stuff. No, here I'm going into that territory. So it was funny. So after that place closed, Lars said, let's go get some blow. So we drove to someplace in Oakland, I remember. Mm. Some house, you know, on a street, and he pulls up his car. Well, you stay right here. I'll be right back. So I was like, fuck that, because he was knocking on the door for a while. So I was like, what's going on? So I got out of the car. I went up, and I go, let's go. There's nobody here. Like, the sun was coming up, and it was fucked up. And he goes, no, it's okay, man. It's all right. And he's like... And then all of a sudden, the blinds go up, and there's a dude with a rifle cocked, pointed right at Lars's head, about to blow his head off. I go, ah! And Mark goes, hey, man, it's me, man. And the guy goes, oh, no problem. Gun down. Lars goes in. I go back to the car. I didn't go in there.
Right.
Lars comes back. And we go to his house. We go up to, you know, get some beers. He had an elevator in his house. First house I ever went to that had an elevator. Yeah. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So then as we're partying, he goes, Sebastian, I want to take you down in the garage. And I want to play you the ultimate car stereo of all time. I was like, kill. We always used to go in my garage in Jersey in my car and get f***ed up and listen to my stereo.
Listen to tunes, yeah.
Yeah. So I go, okay. So we go down there. We sit in his car. And he's like, okay, you ready? Yeah. And he turns it all on. It's all lit up. He looks at me. He's got it cranked. There's no sound. Like, what? He goes, hang on a second, man. He keeps f***ing with it. There's no sound, nothing. And then he turns around, he looks in the back seat, and his windows have been smashed out. And where the speakers used to be was like two wires coming out of the side of his car. And he's like, oh, f***, man. And then, but he just starts laughing. Ah, ha, ha, because he's so rich.
Yeah.
Like, who cares? He's in Metallica.
Yeah.
So that was funny. But then, you know, we went upstairs. We kept partying. All of a sudden, there's a knock on the door. It's like 11 a.m., 12 noon or something. We're gone, shaking. And we think it's the fucking guy with the rifle. We don't know who the fuck it is. The door opens up, and in walks my grandma.
Like, what?
She goes, Sebastian. And I'm so high that I can't even, like, I can't.
Right.
And I have forgotten that I had told my grandma that I was spending the night at Lars and she could come get me. We're going to have a day together at a family reunion. And so I had to get right at noon while Lars went to bed. He's drinking beers, going to sleep. He's laughing his fucking head off.
Did he say hi to your grandma?
Oh, yeah. He's laughing. He goes, hey, Sebastian, it's your grandma. So then me and grandma, yeah. I was acting for some weird reason. I was okay.
Because it's your grandma,
that's
too.
That's messed up, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How could I be okay?
Right.
That's fucked up. Yeah, yeah. This was a long time ago.
But that's what I mean. It's warts and all. You're telling the stories.
If you're writing a book, you got to write an entertaining book. Mm. One thing I've got to say about the book is that one thing I didn't foresee. Some people were mad that they weren't in it enough. I'm not going to mention names.
Okay.
But it's like humorous.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, dude, like, you know, why wasn't I in this part more or whatever? I go, I didn't sit down for 4 years and have a list of people that I'm going to put in my book. A list of people I'm not. I just tortured myself to make something worth reading, mm-hmm. no matter what it was. Like, there's like weird sequences in the book of dreams that I've had that are strange.
Mm-hmm.
That the book company's like, well, we should leave those in there, or should we take them out? I go, I'll leave them in there. And they're like, yeah, because it's like dynamics. If you've got all craziness, yeah. It's like boring.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have light and shade,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
there was
one version of the book that never came out that they put all the bad shit like at the beginning. Like, they had me doing lines of speed with Lemmy in his apartment before we put out our first record. I go, what are you doing? I go, the reason I got to that was because of this.
The record.
If I was doing that before that, what a loser. What a sad loser. I wasn't doing speed with Lemmy before I put out my record. Ah!
But you got to beware of that sort of stuff.
Yes, because I wouldn't have ever met Lemmy.
Yeah, yeah.
If I didn't put out a record.
The first record.
Yeah, it's like.
Right.
Everything had to be a sequence. There was another version that had they took out all of the time and dates that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I go, why would you do that?
It gets very confusing as the reader to follow.
If it's not, that's right. But to me, it's like that's what he's doing now.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's out with Lars doing blow.
Right, right, right. Today.
This has to say 1990.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I always was very cognizant of that, and also saying how old I was at the time. For me, like when I read a book, I always went, I wonder how old he was.
Right.
So I'd always drop in. I was 31 at the time.
Because certain things you would do then are not cool then.
Right. When I was 23,
exactly.
You know, I was doing this,
yes.
Which makes sense for a 23-year-old, you know?
Exactly.
But, I mean, once again, so many great stories, entertaining stories, and there's a real great relationship with you and Axl Rose for 25 years.
Yeah.
Which we saw firsthand at Eddie Trunk's studio, the famous story when we were there. And he's like, dude, I got a text from Axl Rose. And he was nowhere. He was hiding at the time.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know?
And we didn't think he was, I didn't think he was going to come to the studio.
Oh, I was like, come on, there's no way he's coming.
And then he f-ing did.
He showed up.
That was legendary.
But then that led to you guys kind of reigniting your friendship, because you were friends in the early 90s touring with Guns N' Roses and Skid Row.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Skid Row. We opened up the full Use Your Illusion tour, USA and Europe.
Mm.
And, you know, you got to mention shit like that to clarify history, because people don't really history gets rewritten as the years go on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fact right there, folks. I know you read in the press, Metallica and Faith No More opened up the Use Your Illusion tour most of the time. We opened the first
So you're
pass.
Talking the actual first tour. You're talking about the stadium tour that was Metallica and Faith. But you
well, that was after we were done.
Right.
Yeah, then we went on our own headline tour. With
and how huge was that in early 90s?
It was as big as you could get. It was three nights in every place, not one night. And neither of us had a record. Okay, Slave to the Grind didn't come out till like a month into that tour.
Wow.
Guns N' Roses didn't have Use Your Illusion till after Slave to the Grind. Neither of us had a new record.
Right.
And we were doing four sold out nights in every city.
Just because both bands were so huge.
Well, they're bigger than us. Let's get honest. But we were very big too.
But you guys were at your peak as well.
We were like, you know, we sold 20 million. They sold like 100 million.
Yeah. But you think about early 91, the four bands all debuted at number one. It was Guns N' Roses, Skid Row, Metallica.
You walk around these walls and you can go count them up. And
you got all
there's
your gold
big,
records hanging
big,
on the wall. And stuff. I was actually thinking how cool it would have been if when Guns N' Roses did the reunion tour that you guys did
that
it
could
as
have
well.
Happened.
You know?
You know, I don't know if I can get into that, but there was talk of all that and it's...
Yeah.
It's a crazy situation.
But once again, that's something that you said you always get constantly... asked about this and constantly Skid Row.
Well, I know why. Because we're five human beings on a planet that are still alive, that have this opportunity sitting in front of us that we are just collectively not taking. Mm-hmm. And people are like, what a bunch of fucking idiots. Not... I include myself in that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because I'm part of it, but I don't know what else I can do. I don't know what else I can't do. I don't know what else to do. All I know is that I have a manager, Rick Sales.
Mm-hmm.
He deals with them, and that's the only way it's going
to
happen.
Mm-hmm. So kind of waiting to see. In the meantime, you're going to make another record.
Yes.
Like you said.
Yes.
Vinyl, 70s style.
Yeah, I want to make an album that sounds like the albums that I love, mm-hmm. production-wise. But listen to Kick and Scream right now. It sounds great.
But you work a lot, dude. You're constantly touring. I mean, it's a rare time that you're home right now.
Yes.
But you're out. I mean, we were actually in Mexico City. We had a show there, and you were there as well.
We did 50 cities from October to December.
Mm-hmm.
That includes a book tour. But we did 40, my solo band, we did 40 shows.
40 shows in that time frame.
In 3 months.
We got to switch the side now, or switch the record. We're not sure exactly what we got yet. The vinyl continues.
Keep the Bach going.
Keep the Bach going.
I like to Bach, baby.
It's great, though, just looking around here. You got an awesome picture of the Eagles.
That's
a great picture. You got
rare piece.
The Rush little dolls there. You know, so much cool
Music
stuff.
Award.
The American. Oh, wow. From favorite new artist, heavy metal. Yeah. See, but all that, once again, all that stuff, it just reads so well in the book because you had so many great experiences.
Well, this is, you know, when you go to the bookstore, there's no books on Skid Row. There's books on every other band.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's five Bon Jovi books. Steven Adler's mom has a book.
Yeah.
But there's zero on Skid Row.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's books on Cinderella, I think.
There probably is. Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Not well read, but yeah.
So this was the first chance. And I fully expect and welcome Rachel to do a book, Snake to do a book, and probably completely different perspective.
But the interest is there to
yeah,
read it,
I would think.
The story has never been told.
That's right.
You know? What I like, too, about your book, too, is because, I mean, you're a big dude. You were on the scene at, like, 15 years old.
Yeah.
You know, because if you had, you puffed your hair out.
I did.
6'5" or whatever. Yeah. You probably looked like you were 20 years old.
And that was the times when we wore so much makeup.
Right.
Like, tons.
Yeah. How were you doing that at 15 years old, though?
I was 14 when I first played Larry's Hideaway. And I was just so tall, and I looked like just tons of makeup. And they didn't – like, I was just so big. They didn't – you can't –
assumed.
Yeah, and I wore boots.
Right.
I was fucking like a gazelle.
Yeah, it's such a long time ago that you actually had pubic hair to light on fire. It's a great story.
It's true. That's how long ago that was.
You actually had your pubes lit on fire.
Yeah, I actually got crabs because there was somewhere for them to live.
Why did your pubes get lit on fire again?
I was at Pure Platinum down in Florida.
Yeah.
Just drunk. See, I can't drink whiskey. I can't. The only, there's something about my personality that cannot handle hard alcohol. Mm-hmm. I can't handle it.
Yeah.
I can't. It goes in my blood and I'm fucked. I'm crazy.
Right.
I've seen you get crazy.
Well, both of us got crazy.
At Jekyll and I that night, I don't know what you were drinking, but you were like me when I drink Jack. Like, you're wild. Like, like smashing shit and loud. And
we went to see your show, yes. And it was a very...
With a baseball player.
It was a baseball player, Scott...
Scott Gordon or something?
I can't remember.
Something
like Scott, that. I can't remember his last name, but it was you, me, Adrian Smith.
From
Iron Maiden. Paul Gargano and Scott, I can't remember his last name, he was a pitcher for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yes.
And we went and saw your show, and then afterwards went to the local... pub.
Went right across the street from the Plymouth Theater.
Yeah, and got...
Just where Hamilton is playing now.
I'll okay.
Yeah.
Super loaded.
Yeah. A restaurant.
Restaurant, yeah. Rolling around on the floor.
Some funny pictures exist funny of that. Picture. Well, if you should find that and make that the picture of this podcast.
Put it up there. Condiments, spraying condiments at each other, spitting beer in each other's face. Spit beer in my face, dude. Do it. I think there was some crying involved. I think you might have kissed me on the lips. It was a great, great night. But afterwards, I believe that you were...
They sent me a letter to the theater next day that said, "Dear Sebastian, you are welcome here at our establishment anytime. You are such a talented, nice man. However, your friends are not permitted within this establishment henceforth, hitherto from this point forward. Chris Jericho and Paul Gargano will not be admitted into these premises."
Banned from the pub across.
Banned from Broadway.
Yeah. Woo!
Yeah, banned from Broadway.
But that's what happened. I went totally nuts.
What were you drinking?
A Crown Royal at the time.
That's
what got me nuts.
I can't do that.
Yeah.
I can drink wine, and I cut way back. I haven't drank in a while. I just don't enjoy it that much.
Yeah.
But anything more than wine, I can't handle it.
So you were on the whiskey at Pure Platinum?
Yes. And I just thought it would be funny to fucking jump up there in the cage. They had a cage. And I pulled my pants down, I was dancing, and I lit my pubic hair on fire. And I didn't remember that I was a blackout drunk.
Yeah.
So that was a blackout. And this just recently, like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I was on the road somewhere, and some guy comes up and he goes, "Dude, I was there that night." I go, "What are you talking about?" "Because that fucking night in Pure Platinum." I go, "What?" He goes, "When you lit your pubes on fire." I go, "What are you talking about?" And then he described, I go, and I totally remember doing that, that I fell asleep in the back of a pickup truck. Mm-hmm. I gave somebody my Skid Row tour leather as a present. Oh. The guy that let me sleep in his truck.
Like the actual leather jacket.
Yeah, Sebastian Bach, Skid Row, like my pride and joy.
You never saw it again?
No, the next day... We went back down there and found the dude and got my jacket back. The whole crew, they're like, "What? You're f***ing leathers? No way, man. That's not happening."
So talking about how much of a fan you are, and so many great stories. You got to tour with Aerosmith. You're touring with Bon Jovi. You're out with, you know, hanging with Metallica dudes and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the guys that you met that meant the most when you finally get to meet them in person?
Well, you got to say Aerosmith, like Steve Tyler, and because any of the 70s bands are even more lauded than the 80s
sure, than the
bands.
80s guys, yeah.
Like, everybody worships Guns N' Roses, rightfully so. They're the biggest band in the world. But when they came out, I was already, like, you know.
You guys are more peers than.
They're like buddies.
Yeah.
Like Rush. I can't even handle it when I hang out with Alex Lifeson or, like, he emails me sometime. I look at the screen and I want to print it out and frame
everyone,
it. Like it's a collector's edition.
Yeah.
And that freaks, like, the bands you listen to when you were a kid, that mm-hmm. freaks you out. Well, you know, one time, even guys that are, you know, older than that, like I did a TV show a long time ago called Celebrity Duets with Hal Sparks. Mm-hmm. And also on the show was Smokey Robinson.
Yeah.
And Gladys Knight. And I was just hanging with them in the back room. In the 92 Juno Awards, I got to present Male Vocalist of the Year to Leonard Cohen. I did.
Wow.
And me and Leonard Cohen were buddies that day. We not ever once talked about music. Mm-hmm. I knew he was from Quebec, and my stepmother.
He was Canadian?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Leonard Cohen's from Montreal. Okay. So Leonard, I knew he was from Montreal, and my stepmom was from Montreal. I used to spend time in Sherbrooke. Mm-hmm. So I go, have you ever been to Sherbrooke? And he knew all about the streets and the rest. That's what we talked about. We never even talked about.
Connect right away just on that.
Just about restaurants and food.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that because people look at him like such a god, you know?
Right. Interesting, though, on the other side of the coin, in your book, you talk about the Ace Frehley experience. Even the Paul Stanley, too, when he came to Jekyll and Hyde, kind of like a little bit of a letdown.
Well, I think that this book is about being very innocent mm-hmm. as a kid and wide-eyed and full of wonder. And then you go through life and shit happens where to everybody, and this is just my story, but everybody has things that are disillusioning or mm-hmm. or that you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the name of Scott Ian's radio show?
Oh, Don't Meet Your Heroes or something like
right.
that?
Right. Well, there's something to that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want anything negative vibes or anything, but the thing is, I did write that song, and the thing is.
The song with Ace?
I would say that this book is a love letter to Kiss.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
Completely. I would say there's nothing but love. Like, yeah. I did write that song, and it does break my heart mm-hmm, that he mm-hmm. left my name off.
But when it came out, he didn't give you credit for the song, yeah.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
But that's because I'm, like, seen in the industry, oh, he's the front man. Mm-hmm. I'm the songwriter. Go fuck yourself with all that. Like, I'm the songwriter. You're the singer. Whoever comes up with the idea, you know, deserves the credit for the mm-hmm. idea. Like, that really, that's always been a thing with me. That you know, people like to put me in this box, but listen to everything I've ever put out. My shit is like one thing. Mm-hmm. Like it is.
Sure.
Because I am a demanding son of a bitch. But anybody good is.
Sure.
Anybody that's good demands the best.
I think, too, just going back to the Ace thing, I think, once again, this the realities of the business. Like, he, you know, mm-hmm. Ace Frehley, he's going to take the publishing.
Right.
Because that's how it works, you know, and that's. I don't even know if it's it sucks, but I think that's kind of when you realize how the world really works. That's probably
been
how
done
it
to
is.
Him
a thousand times, right? You know what I mean? So for him, I remember we went to see him. Actually, Vinny and I, Vinny Paul, went and saw Ace at the Trees Lounge in Dallas, and there was like a huge lineup of people for his VIP, and he was just sitting there and wasn't quite ready to do it yet. And it's like a Monday or Tuesday. He finally goes on at 10:30 at night, and it's like. You're supposed to go on at night. Dude, you can't do that.
People got to work.
They got to work. And you're making these poor people that have spent, I don't know, $100 to get your autograph. And it's like, I'm just not ready yet. And like, I think that's just how it is for him. He's been a rock star all these years and just, I'll do it when I'm ready, you know?
If you listen to the song in question, it is so fucking scary. It's insane.
What's the song called?
It used to be called I Like My Rock Hard. And now it's called Foxy and Free.
Okay, and that was on the Anomaly.
It used to be called You Make It Hard for Me. You make it so hard to say. Not the best.
Right.
And now, you got Foxy and Free. You're not a Foxy to me. That's So you make it hard for me. Became foxy and free.
Yeah. You gotta laugh though, right?
Well, what are you gonna do?
You know, because that's the
thing. I don't care. Whatever. I do care. It really does hurt because I don't like. Okay, it all really. I say the same thing about 18 in Life when I change the melody. Mm-hmm. You can go listen to the guy that was in the band before me on YouTube, and then listen to what I did. The difference is was from my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't tell me that this note is worth credit, but this note is not worth credit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's been a recurring thing in my life that bugs me. I just read the Mike Love book with the Beach Boys.
Oh, dude, I got it in my bag. Is
I just
good?
Read it.
Is
well, it's good, but it talks just like what I'm talking about.
Gotcha.
Like he helped write all these tunes.
So he's writing the melody lines for the
tunes? He's writing the words and melody lines, but then just not – his name's not on it. It's like mm-hmm. Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, I understand that frustration. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a genius. Well, he's the singer.
Right.
Give me a f***ing break.
Yeah. But the melody line counts as part of the songwriting, though.
Melody line does. But,
sure it does.
But the thing is, when you're recording it, I don't know anybody would buy it.
Right.
I was into bands like Wrathchild, Stack Attack, and
who later became
Kick-Axe.
Oh, I love Kick-Axe, dude.
This was my brand. I didn't know. Like, I thought if I got in a band, we put out a record, maybe we could be like Kick-Axe.
Yeah.
I didn't know we would sell millions of records.
And at the time, you think because Kick-Axe has an album,
they were huge to me.
Yeah, they must be.
Well, yeah, but I wasn't even.
Three albums?
I wouldn't even care about being rich, but yes.
But you think.
Yes.
They're huge.
Yes.
They got an album.
I know.
In the store.
I know.
You know, then they got another album.
I know. But being a Canadian big band is different than being an American big band.
Yeah, and even big band is not even using the right word, you know?
Well, it's like Alex Lifeson said in this special that the record companies over there are more like outposts. I laughed. That's what, it's like here's the Capitol Records outpost. That's what it
that
is.
That guy is so funny.
He is
Alex
funny.
Lifeson, super.
He's
funny.
Hilarious.
Another great thing in the book is you talk about your time. This is really obscure, but as a metalhead, Madam X. When you're in Madam
X. Yeah, you have to tell the story.
It's great stuff though. Like because you at the time you're thinking like once again it's a big band. They got an album in
I
the store.
I did think that, yeah.
You know, and that dude.
But that's really where I found out how hard it is to be a vocalist.
In what
to
way?
Not lose your voice. Like, to charge money to have people come here and you sing. You better f***ing know how to sing.
Right.
Like, back then, there was no in-ears. There was no any. It was just like, go for it, dude.
You got to find the sweet spot on stage where you might be able to hear yourself
and that's
and
just sing. Back then, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I was a kid. I was 15 in that band.
In Madam X, you were 15?
15, 16 at the most.
And you're traveling the States.
Yeah, I toured the States.
Who are you touring with? Just Madam X?
Yeah. Madam
headlining?
X. Yeah, in clubs, you know, bars.
You're high in high school.
Yeah, I sang that every night. She's hot tonight! She's hot tonight! Good looking! She likes her meat well done! She likes her meat well done.
There's a huge scream in that song.
Oh, no, there's wicked screams in there. Yeah. Brent Keiser is a great singer. But I my throat wasn't ready to do that, and that chapter ends with Chris Dolliver spitting in my face on stage because I couldn't sing. I could sing for a little bit, but like 2 hours a night. And with Madam X, it was easier when I was in Kid Wicked because it was all cover versions,
right?
So, you know, I knew Smoking in the Boys' Room, but you know, doing all originals, Madam X, we didn't do any covers.
Okay.
So I was doing all Brett Keiser stuff and trying to find my own sound. And
I love I don't think the story's in the book, but you told me before where they called you one day and said, like, okay, dude, we got the big tour.
Yeah,
Madam X, you're like, we got the big tour. You're like, what is it, Motley Crue? Right? No, Foghat. Is that true? I think you told me that.
I think so, yeah. Are they people going to come?
Foghat.
Those guys are still touring. More than Skid Row is.
So when you're putting together all the ideas for the book, did they all come to mind at once? Or like I made like a list, and I would put 10 story ideas down and then screw off for a while, back, add some more.
The beginning was very easy because I had all these archives of these pictures that I knew I wanted to incorporate, so I had a good idea about that. Then when I was done with that part, I found myself saying, okay, what do I really want to write about? And I thought, well, how about start by telling stories that you tell, like, at dinner to people that makes them go, what the f-? Just start with that.
Yeah.
And I had lots of stories. So by the time I was done with a lot of those, it's 450 pages.
Just from those.
Just yeah. From, yeah. And then I tied them all chronologically to where it made sense.
A little bit of a storyline.
Yes.
Did you have problems editing anything? I know for me it was hard to
edit. No, I had problems with who was editing it.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
I don't want to put anybody under the bus.
But basically.
Yeah, I didn't like, I'm a control freak. Like, one of the people would say, why was the book pushed back? One of the major things that was pushed back from was italics.
Really?
I like to use different punctuation and stuff, and like when Stephen King, I love Stephen King's writing. Mm-hmm. When he tells in The Shining of like a dream or something, it's like all in italics, right? And if I don't know
to
why,
show that it's different. It's
yes.
A different
so thing. I have tons of that in the book. Some fucking editor just took them all out. I go, if you think that you're taking my italics out. And it was a major thing.
Nobody takes my italics, man. Nobody.
It was like, I'm going to fly to New York and show you about italics. Do not f*** with my any italics, man. But it was like that.
Yeah.
And I was offended, storming around the house. I go, you can never f*** edit a Stephen King book. Send.
But when you're looking back on all those tales, and I mean, you made it very young. 19,
yeah, I did.
20,
a maybe. Baby.
I mean, how old was the first Skid Row when you first joined?
I was born in 68.
So, dude,
our album came out January 6, 89.
So you're 20.
19.
You're 2019 area. I mean, no wonder you did so many crazy things. And
I didn't even know what was right from wrong when you're 19.
Right, you're talking, you opened the book with the bottle incident, which is the famous story, but you're 19.
I thought you're supposed to do that.
Right.
I thought that was rock and roll.
Looking back now, you're kind of like, holy shit, did I not know what I was doing?
I know, because you're entertaining people. Mm-hmm. It's not. Back then, you remember, I'm a little bit older than you, but I think it was Motley Crue who brought this in. When I was a teenager, somebody said, your band sucks. Mm-hmm. It was your duty to fight that person. That's,
yeah.
If you did
you're
it,
gang,
if you
right.
didn't, your band did suck.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, excuse me? What did you just say?
Right.
And it was a real fight. Mm-hmm. Like, I
hold it. Did you?
But that, again, people, that was a long time ago, and that's the way it was then.
But like, for example, when you're talking about the bottle incident.
Hi.
No, he's saying hi. He's back. Trace is back. When you're talking about the bottle incident, and we're winding down here, getting near the end, but it seemed like it was that little bit cathartic for you, because I remember you weren't really
writing about it.
Yeah, because you could never talk about.
No, I couldn't even say sorry to the person that I hurt.
Right.
They said, because that would change the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So for years, I felt like shit.
Because you basically jumped in the pit. You broke a guy's jaw or broke a girl's jaw.
Both.
A girl and a guy. Fans at the show.
Yeah. Nice. There's a fun night out.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny, man? Well, nothing. Nothing's funny about that.
Right.
For years, I couldn't say sorry. So I knew right away the first thing I wanted to write. I go, what do you want to write? I go, that's what I want to write. And I captured that. HarperCollins wanted me to have a ghostwriter. They wanted me to have a co-writer of this book. That was part of the initial deal. I said, I'm not interested in that. I don't want to do that. And they go, okay, smarty pants. Hang on, dude. Hang on. So they go, okay. Write something. You know,
like you're auditioning to write your book.
Yeah, I had to do that. And that's what I wrote. I wrote that intro of the bottle.
Hmm.
Because I knew I could write that.
Yeah.
I knew I could.
It's a great
So I started with
too.
That, and they go, okay, we love what you wrote. Mm-hmm. You go ahead, write your book.
As a result, I found with some of my books, it is cathartic to write about a certain experience. Then I could put it in the book. It's lasting forever, and I don't have to think about it as much anymore.
Right.
Well, it's gone.
It's amazing you said that. I got to say this to everybody. Every time, you know, a lot of people, when I'm out in public or whatever, they want to come and tell me all these stories about the 80s. Because they look at me and they remember all this shit. And sometimes that gets on my nerves because I'm not thinking about 30 years ago all the time. I'm not walking around in 2017 thinking about 89. But people like in an airport or just
very recognizable,
and they all have a real heartfelt story that I want to hear sometimes. Mm-hmm. But if you talk about cathartic, writing 450 pages about mainly the 80s and the effect that it had going forward and that time that people love to talk about, that was cathartic. Like, here you go. You want to hear what I think about what happened in the 80s? Here is 450 pages of that.
Yeah.
Have at it.
Right.
I don't have to fucking talk. Yeah. Here you go.
Just read it.
Here.
Yeah.
Knock yourself out. It's the 80s.
You know what else too? I think as we grow older, you realize, like you said, people do have these stories, and I want to hear them more. Whereas before,
yeah,
I didn't want to as
That's
much.
That's right. Well, because guess what? We're not going to remember all this. To get this on paper, that time of history before the internet.
Mm-hmm.
All of these stories
come strictly
before,
from your mind. Yeah.
Before the internet.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
And there's not a lot of books about that period. There's mm-hmm. not like Motley Crue, The Dirt. Duff McKagan's book.
Yeah, both his books
there's
are great.
There's not a lot. There's like
there's a few, but
there's
nothing,
not
no,
a lot.
No.
There's a lot of books about the 70s,
mm-hmm.
but there's going to be more about the 80s. There's going
to
be.
Because it's an entertaining time. It's
yeah.
fun to read those stories.
It is fun.
And I think so, like for you, like as a musician, starting in bands when you're 12, 13, 14, here we are mm-hmm. now in 2017, and you have a couple songs, two or three songs that people will always remember, and it's
yeah.
associated with you.
That's right.
That's pretty cool, man.
Well, yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'd say more than two because 18 in Life, I Remember You, Youth Gone Wild, Monkey Business. People love
sure,
that shit.
Sure, they remember
those. And you know what?
Forever.
In other parts of the world, Wasted Time, Quicksand Jesus. Like when we go to South America and I do Wasted Time in Brazil, it's insane. They I don't know what it is about that tune, but a lot of people love that one.
I remember seeing Rush in Brazil, like some rock, and they played Closer to the Heart.
Oh.
And they said they could not get out of Brazil without playing Closer. And you're thinking, Closer to the Heart, like it's okay tune, but there in Brazil,
yeah, Brazil.
It's the song.
Well, on my album Angel Down, the ballad By Your Side was a radio hit in Brazil. It was the only country. Thank you, Brazil! But it was like they sent me the charts and
sure.
It was a big hit.
I found that interesting too in the book when you talked about how your expectations for Angel Down, you had so many expectations.
I thought it was going to be like just like those albums.
When it was not, once again.
Well, you know, I don't want, that was my first record I ever put out after the internet. I don't count Bring 'Em Back Alive because that was like 97
compilation sort
but
of
also
as well,
but
yeah.
also the internet wasn't so all-encompassing.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, the record company that put out Angels Down, it was Caroline Records, Merovingian Records. I can't even say that word. I can now because I had to learn. But you can't compete with like Atlantic
sure.
Records.
And plus the times have changed too.
Yeah.
You know, 2007, 2008. But it was interesting to read about that. Like I said.
Oh, I went crazy when that. I thought it was going to be a number one album. Mm-hmm. It was me and Axel.
Yeah, I mean,
how could it not?
He hadn't done anything on record.
I 100% thought that would be. But you know what? As time's gone by, people love that album.
Mm-hmm.
American Metalhead is one of the only songs that I can put next to Youth Gone Wild in the set. You know, it's like we always try to do new songs, but very few remain in the set as the years go by. Yeah, because
yeah.
you got to entertain the crowd
and
you have to play what they know. But American Metalhead, that destroys the crowd.
How do you decide your set when you do your shows
just
nowadays?
By crowd reaction, mm-hmm. but also vocally. I have changed the way I do headline shows. I open up for myself. I can't do sound checks anymore.
Oh, okay.
I can't book 40 shows 5 nights a week, you know
mm-hmm.
I can't.
Yeah, how it is, yeah.
I cannot show up at 4 in the afternoon and sing 4 or 5 songs for the sound man and go back to my hotel and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
That is too much. That's too much. I can do that sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but as far as my singing voice, it's better for me to warm up to sing and do my show.
So how do you do it?
I just warm. I come out and I start with ballads now. Like a sound check.
Okay.
Like my set was, I come out, start with Lil Wayne. Jimi Hendrix that people love. Then I'll do Breaking Down of Subhuman Race. Then Battle with the Bottle, which is an obscure tune that from Gone Country. Yeah. Then 18 Life.
Interesting.
And it, but the crowd fucking loves it. Then I'll either do Quicksand Jesus or Rock and Roll is a Vicious Game because we were in Canada.
April 1.
Then I'll do I Remember You. Then I'll walk off the stage, change my fucking outfit, come back and do Big Guns or Slave to the Grind. Then all metal. And the crowd loves it.
That's interesting.
The reason I do that is because everything is filmed. Mm-hmm. Everybody films every show. It goes up on Blabbermouth the next day. So vocally, that works for me way better to do a song like I Remember You before I do Monkey Business.
Yeah, yeah.
And have to do I Remember You after Monkey Business, I'm like this. It's not the same. Different energy.
Well, and like you said too, if you know, if you're filming everything, and heaven forbid if you have a bad show, you know, that's going to be there forever.
What people don't get about that whole thing is that we didn't always sound perfect in 1989.
Right.
Like, nothing was filmed at all then. We would film our shows, Skid Row, right?
Yeah.
Then we'd watch them, and it's the same as it is now. It's like some was good, some wasn't.
Yeah.
And we would release the good
shit. But that's live rock and roll.
Yeah, he didn't just film it, put it out.
Yeah.
You're allowed to watch it.
Yeah, you're
allowed to produce it. That's part of the art of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I remember this big controversy in the late 90s. Kiss did overdubs on Kiss Alive.
Oh,
I'm like, what? You people are stupid. Like, that's part of showbiz.
Mm-hmm.
And you're allowed to do that.
You talked to Paul, and most of the record was overdubbed.
But all of these live.
But he's got a great point. He's like, I'm in 8-inch heels. I'm jumping up and down. There's pyro going off. I'm, you know,
you don't make
you
records
can't sound perfect.
You do not make studio records running.
Yeah.
You're standing there. And frozen and drinking water and the lights are right and you try it 10 times and you pick the best one out of 10. That's part of it, though. It's like painting a picture. You're allowed to paint a piece of shit picture, throw it out, and try again. Like, that's, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Only in theater do you only have one shot. Only, or radio, live radio.
Yeah.
Live theater.
Live rock and roll. Yeah, exactly. Last question. Is there a story that you enjoyed writing the most in your book?
Oh, I got to say the Kiss concert, the same thing that you liked.
Yeah.
For some, you know, I have to give credit where credit's due. When I saw the Kiss Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony with Tom Morello, the speech he gave.
Amazing.
Electrified me. Just made me feel what it was like to be a little kid Kiss fan again.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, Sebastian, you've got to write that in your book, that feeling of that. Mm-hmm. And I did.
Yeah.
But I had actually started writing that before that speech. But when I saw his speech, I knew he raised the fucking bar with his words that he chose to induct Kiss. He's like, can you imagine coming from space and you see this guy breathing fire and fucking and it made me so excited.
Yeah.
So I go, in my book, I have got to capture that excitement. You got to.
You did. It's a great story.
Thank you, dude.
It's a great book, man.
Thank you so much.
Skid Row, dude.
And I love your books too, Chris. Thanks, man. And you got three out.
Three, fourth.
That is so impressive.
And you're going to do another one?
Yeah, I sure am. Right on.
High five, man.
When are we going to play some gigs?
I've been waiting to do it, man.
No,
it's our record will be out in May.
I just toured with Buck Cherry.
Oh, dude,
it was great.
It's a great bill.
We did 20 cities.
That'd be a good three.
Yeah, why not?
We could sell some tickets.
Let's
for that.
Go.
Come on, booking agents.
Come on, let's do it.
Do it.
We're better than Mariah Carey.
Tell me about it. Sebastian's book is called 18 in Life in Skid Row, and it's got so many more crazy rock and roll stories. You can tell Sebastian definitely has no problem. He pulls no punches. He tells it like it is. He is deep down inside a great guy and super, super funny. It's a long book, but it's good. Really easy to read, and since Spaz wrote it himself, you can hear it. Hear his voice in your head telling these stories as you're reading. It's very similar to Lion's Tale or Best in the World or Undisputed. Or my new book, Noah's a Four-Letter Word, which comes out in August. When you write it yourself, it's your voice, and Chaz definitely did that. He put in the time. He put in the effort. You owe it to yourself if you love rock and roll to check it out. It's a great, great story. Thanks again to Baz. Had a great time hanging at his house in L.A. with Trace, talking and listening to tunes. And while I'm handing out thanks, thanks to, of course, the great Talk is Jericho sponsors, including DDP Yoga. All you got to do is go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to get 25% off all DDP Yoga related merch and 50% off a max pack or a combo pack. You get the second one for 50% off. The price is already 25% off, like we said. Thanks also to Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/talk to save $3 when you order the Road to WrestleMania crate. Just go to podcast1.com, hit the killer deals button in the right corner of the page, then go to Talk is Jericho because I got to keep things rolling. I got my own show here twice a week. I got a whole podcast network, including the newest podcast hit on the Jericho Network, The Raven Effect. It's featuring my old friend Raven. He's insane. He's crazy. He's intelligent. He's funny. And he's obsessed with pop culture and muckety muck. The first episode is out and the ratings are tremendous. We've got a hit on our hands already. Looking forward to episode 2 on Monday. Go subscribe on iTunes right now so you don't miss out every Monday. And go ahead and subscribe to all the great Jericho podcasts. Of course, Beyond the Darkness 5 days a week. Team Tiger Awesome every Sunday. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus. They got the lovely Dawn Marie giving her expose of what was like behind the curtain in ECW. And then, of course, Conan, keeping it 100 with Conan, the flagship monster hit on Talk is Jericho. This week, Raven is on that show. Pete Gass from the Mean Street Posse is on there. Juventud Guerrera, the whole gang. And listen, I want you guys to do me a favor. Go on iTunes, and when you go to subscribe to Talk is Jericho, even if you've subscribed already, leave a comment. I want to get those numbers up. We're at about 1,400 comments right now. I want us to get to 2,000 comments. There's other podcasts out there that have a lot of comments, and those mean a lot to advertisers. They mean a lot to other people checking out different shows. The comments are very, very important. The number of comments, and I think there's no reason why we can't have the most comments. So Talk is Jericho, Sexy Beast listeners, please go leave a comment and a rating right now. I know there's millions of you out there. We're almost at 190 million downloads. I'd like to get over 2,000 comments very quickly. Can you go do that for me? Help out your boy. Help me out, and I promise I'll keep you entertained twice a week, including on March 15th, 2017, when we got the biggest podcast ever as Mick Foley joins Talk is Jericho, less than 2 weeks away. So keep listening for that, and keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday, one of the longest-running employees in the WWE and have been in the rest of the business for 40 years, Downtown Bruno, Harvey Whippleman, Bruno Lauer. He's done every job in the WWE, and he is here on Talk is Jericho on Wednesday. I went to his house in Memphis a few months ago, and we had a fine old conversation about Jerry Lawler and The Rock and Bruce Pritchard and everybody else, Jim Ross, his whole history. He was even the Divas champion at one point. You're not going to want to miss Downtown Bruno, Harvey Whippleman. It's going to be a great show. It's this Wednesday, so you are going to love it. We will see you then. In the meantime, and in between time, have a great weekend. Stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.